Presenting Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth. Follow the Antrobus family through the ages as they survive flood, fire, pestilence, the double feature, and the mundane trifles of everyday life from our Ice Age to World War. Performances run from Wednesday, April 6th through Sunday, April 17th. For more information, call 351-2528.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with Buddhist scholar and practitioner David Loy. He is a professor in the Faculty of International Studies at Bunkyo University, which is near Tokyo in Japan. Previously, he taught in the philosophy department of the National University of Singapore and is interested in, among other things, in comparative philosophy. And as he was just explaining to me here just a moment ago, more and more in recent years, he's been interested in the idea of applying Buddhist ethics and the Buddhist approach to social issues. We will talk a little bit about that in this second hour of Focus 580. He is here visiting the campus. He last night gave the Marjorie Hall Thulin lecture. This is he is the 2005 Marjorie Hall Thulin Visiting Scholar in Religion and Contemporary Culture. He gave a talk last night about an issue that he has spoken a lot about a great deal and has written on, and that is religion and the market, and his idea that in a way, consumerism has become the religion of our time. We'll talk more about that in a minute. I'll get him to explain exactly what that means. We're pleased that he could be with us here this morning and talk. And, of course, we'd like to involve people who are listening in the conversation as well. So if you have questions, you'd like to make comments, that's perfectly fine. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that people try to be brief just so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. Of course, anyone who is listening this morning is welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here and on the University of Illinois campus.
To start, I'm interested in having you talk about the subject of the religion of the market. This is, you were talking about this last night, and I know that you have written about this and talked about it quite a lot. And you make the basic point that if you look at the functions that religion traditionally has served, that is to help us understand the world and our place in it. Over time, as religion has seemed to provide less, at least some people would say that the answers to those questions that are provided are less and less satisfactory. Somehow its place in doing that, as it has waned, something else has come along, has grown to take its place, which you argue is consumerism. Let's talk about that. What exactly do you mean?
Well, not only consumerism. Consumerism is the one side of it that most of us are probably most exposed to, but you can also look at the other side too. I mean, consumerism is our preoccupation with finding satisfaction or a kind of salvation, really, in the things that we buy and enjoy. But the other side is the production values as well, that for a lot of us too, the other kind of salvation involves making money. So you don't want to separate the production values from the consumption values. But to a large extent, I think that this is functioning as our new religion, that somehow the new God is money and the markets, which enable us to make the money and to spend it on the products that we like to have.
I suspect that for a lot of people, to persuade them of this idea is not a particularly hard sell. I think that there are a lot of people who, when they would hear you say that, would right away say, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I think you're right about that, at least in our seeming preoccupation with getting and spending. I know that there are a lot of people, regardless of their philosophical and religious orientation, who I think would say, yes, I agree. That is a problem. But casting it in terms of religion, I suppose that might be the step too far for some mm-hmm. people.
Well, I think that's because we tend to think of religion as dealing with some other realm, some transcendental realm, heaven up there, where we go when we die. Maybe it helps then to look at it from a Buddhist perspective, because Buddhism doesn't necessarily make that separation. The issue is starting out with our, what Buddhists call our dukkha, our dissatisfaction, our being happy. And the whole point of the Buddhist path is to realize what the source of that dukkha is. And you can understand Buddhism as a clever way to enjoy our lives. Mm-hmm. So Buddhism doesn't necessarily encourage that kind of duality whereby we can separate what we're doing here from where our religion is hoping to get us.
I think maybe there might be some people who have heard at one time or another the idea that there is this essential idea in Buddhism that all life is suffering, and that and having read some things that you have written and some writing, I think your suggestion is that to translate that term dukkha as suffering is not quite right. That's not really the idea. Talk about that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's a very important point, because actually the word dukkha includes a lot of things. Suffering, every form of suffering as we normally think about it, including emotional, mental pain, is only one aspect. In the Buddhist tradition, it's very clear that it also includes just awareness of impermanence in general, so that, for example, even when you're eating an ice cream cone, there's a kind of dukkha because you're aware that the last bite is coming soon, or the last lick. But most profoundly, Buddhism connects dukkha with the false sense of self, and this is the other basic claim that's so important in Buddhism. In fact, I think that it's really what's most unique and special about Buddhism, is that it links up this fundamental dissatisfaction or dis-ease, what I sometimes call lack, with our lack of self, that the sense of self as we normally experience it is not real. And by trying, and because it's not real, we experience it as the sense of, it's shadowed by the sense of lack, and we become preoccupied with different ways of trying to make ourselves feel more real. Mm-hmm. So in a very real way, dukkha most fundamentally refers to a basic dissatisfaction or dis-ease or basic frustration that it's the nature of an unawakened mind to experience, regardless of how fortunate, how healthy, wealthy you might be.
I think this is a really important concept to get across, and something that I think people maybe will have a difficult time with if they're not familiar with the idea already. And interestingly, it hooks back with the very first thing that we were talking about. I think that it is true that different people coming out of different sort of religious, ethical, philosophical traditions, whatever, there may be one thing that they all address, and that is the kind of feeling that I think almost everyone feels at some point, whether it is, and it can be so profound that you can't function, or it also can be just sort of a vague feeling of unease. That is the feeling that something's missing.
Mm-hmm.
And different, again, as I say, so different people come up with a way of explaining that, of talking about, well, what is the thing that is, that people feel that they are missing? What is it? Where does it come from? How do you get at that? So not everybody has the same sort of answer to it, the same analysis. But it does seem to be something that a lot of different people in a lot of different traditions feel they must address. It's a thing that must be addressed. In Buddhism, the lack, that's the term that I know that you use, the empty place, the thing that is missing. As Buddhists think about what that is and why that is, can you explain that? Mm-hmm. What is that when you talk about lack, what is it that you're talking about?
Well, I have to emphasize that term isn't used precisely in Buddhism. It's my attempt to explain Buddhism in modern terms. Mm-hmm. But basically, I think what is so special about Buddhism, as I said, is that it links us with the sense of self. And we tend to think of ourselves as somehow being real or having some essence. But the Buddhist claim is that the sense of self is a construct. It's a social, mental, linguistic concept which is constantly being changed and reconstructed. But because it's a concept, or sorry, because it's a construct, there's something ungrounded about it. And we feel this ungroundedness as a sense of emptiness at our core, and usually experience it as a sense of lack, that something is lacking, I'm missing something, as you said. Mm-hmm. The problem from a Buddhist perspective is that we don't really usually understand what's going on here, and so we tend to think that what we're lacking must be something outside us. In our culture in particular, given the way we're encouraged to think, it's often that we don't have enough money, for example, or maybe we're not famous enough, or maybe we haven't found that right other person to fill in our lack. But the Buddhist claim is that insofar as we're preoccupied with looking outside ourselves, trying to find something that we can attach to that will fill up the lack, that we're looking in the wrong direction, because you can't resolve the problem in that way. And Buddhism offers, in place of that, a kind of spiritual path that makes us more aware of the emptiness at the core of our being. And by dwelling in that, by finding ways to deal with that more directly, then the claim is that a kind of transformation can occur there. Mm-hmm. And of course, given what we just said, you can see how it links so nicely with consumerism, that the whole trap of consumerism is that it plugs into our lack, right? It encourages us to think that the solution to the sense of dis-ease that we feel is somewhere outside us. And always, of course, it's the next thing that we buy that is going to fill up our sense of lack.
And of course, it never does. Because the message always is, if you buy this thing, it's going to be great. You're going to be happy. Your life will be complete. And of course, you do that, and maybe for about 5 minutes, and then, no, it doesn't work, because that doesn't really, whatever the fundamental thing is, no, that doesn't get at it. But it's easy to then get the next message as, well, okay, maybe that thing didn't do it, but maybe this new thing will.
Exactly.
And you can get into that sort of cycle, and never, because it's really not getting at what the basic issue is, it's never going to satisfy it. But of course, we have this industry that's built on persuading you that these things will do that.
The latest issue of the New Yorker had an article on advertising which made the point that last year the United States spent $500 billion on advertising and marketing, which is, well over, $1,600 per person. Mm. As usual, about half the world total. So it just keeps going up and up.
Mm. So what do we do about that? Well, I would say, what does Buddhism say that we do about that?
Well, there's two issues there. I mean, there's the social question of how we address a culture that is encouraging us to understand our lack in those terms, and that's something that is increasingly concerning me, and I haven't worked it out by any means. But in the Buddhist sense of the individual problem, the claim is that we need some kind of meditative technique or process that helps us get in touch with this sense of lack at our core. Instead of projecting it, instead of looking outside ourselves, can we find a way to focus on, to go inside our minds and to focus on that lack in its pure form? The real claim is not that the lack has any essence or substance of its own. Our lack is rather due to the way that we tend to react against and be afraid of this emptiness at our core. But the claim is that if we can stop running away from it and dwell in it, then there's the possibility of a turning around, of a transformation of that. And then we can realize that the sense of self is in fact grounded in something deeper than itself, which of course all the different religions have different names for, but there's the possibility of something springing up from a deeper part of our being. Mm.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is David Loy. He's professor at the Faculty of International Studies at Bunkyo University, which is near Tokyo. He's also a Zen teacher and uses Buddhist and comparative philosophy to think about the modern world and some of the problems that come with modern life. He's the author of a number of books, including Non-Duality, A Study in Comparative Philosophy, Lack and Transcendence, The Problem of Death and Life in Psychotherapy, Existential and Buddhism, A Buddhist History of the West, and he is here visiting the campus I gave a talk last night dealing with some of these very ideas here that we have been talking about. He's the 2005 Marjorie Hall Thulin Visiting Scholar in Religion and Contemporary Culture. Questions are welcome, and we have a couple of people here who are listening in and want to join the conversation. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our first caller is in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I have a great deal of respect for Buddhism going back to the dark days of the Vietnam War when the Buddhist monks courageously launched opposition to the military dictatorship imposed by the United States government, and I've studied it extensively since then. But I have to say, and I'm just asking you, perhaps you could explain this to me, I've also studied a lot about the conflict in Sri Lanka. Mm. And they're the most violent, racist, and vicious, bigoted, almost genocidal individuals and organizations are Buddhists and the Buddhist monks and the Buddhist monasteries. And they are doing everything humanly possible to prevent a peace settlement with the Tamil people. As a matter of fact, the Buddhist organizations down there basically have killed 65,000 Tamils. And it seems to me that this is completely inconsistent with what Buddhism is all about. It's supposed to be a religion of peace. And I just don't understand it. How could Buddhism produce a variant there down in Sri Lanka that is so violent, vicious, racist, and genocidal? Thank you.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that question, and I can only share your sentiments there, because I think what's happened in Sri Lanka is extremely deplorable, and doubly so the fact that Buddhism has become so involved. Let me just say, though, that in general, I think within Asia, the Buddhist tradition has served as a force for peace in most cultures. But as you're very well aware, it certainly hasn't in Sri Lanka. It's really true that if you try to go back to the original teachings of the Buddha, which the Sinhalese claim to do, it's inconsistent what they're doing now, the monks or many of the monks in Sri Lanka, with what the Buddha himself was proposing. What seems to have happened historically, though, is that the Buddhist tradition, or part of it, and I should emphasize it's only part of it, has become entangled with nationalist and Marxist views. And so I think we shouldn't understand that as a good example of Buddhism, but I think one of the kind of unfortunate distortions that happen whenever a religion becomes involved in politics, and Sri Lanka is sort of the classic example of how the monks have become politicized.
Mm. Well, I guess that raises what is a basic question, and it's not just a question for Buddhists to confront, but people of many different faiths to confront, is how do you disentangle essential teachings and politics of the moment, whether it be this moment or some past moment.
Right. Well, it's been a general problem in Asian Buddhism because, of course, Asia wasn't democratic. And in order for Buddhism to be successful as an institution, it unfortunately usually came to some kind of accommodation with ruling classes, with governments, with emperors and dictators, such that they had a lot of control over what the Buddhists were saying. So, you know, they would support the institution of the Sangha, the Buddhist community, but likewise the community was supporting the ruling authorities. And each was scratching the other's back, and that was the most unfortunate thing. What I think is fascinating now that Buddhism is coming to the West, and now that Asia, too, is being exposed to more democratic forces, there's new possibilities for development in Buddhism. Traditionally, Buddhism has very little to say about justice and human rights. The doctrine of karma, the way it's been understood, has been sort of taking the place of that. It's been very easy to say, well, if your suffering is something is wrong with your life, it must be due to your karma. Mm-hmm. But now I think we're getting to the point where greater concerns about social justice are entering into Buddhist understandings and ways of thinking.
Well, it seems, though, that it, my understanding of that, of karma, the idea of karma too, it does say that there are consequences for our actions. And that that should help you decide what's right action and what's wrong action. And it has a lot to do with how it is you treat other living things.
Right.
I would think that that could be an underpinning for an idea of human rights and how it is that you, that other people should be treated.
But it can also work against it. You can look at somebody, say, who's poor, who's suffering, and you can say, well, that's a result of their karma. And likewise, if you really believe in this doctrine of karma and rebirth, then in a way you don't have to worry about justice. Things will take care of themselves, right? You know, what you get, you'll eventually get what you deserve. It's built into the universe, so you don't have to worry so much about making sure that we're doing a good job now with social justice. And that's the kind of trap, I think, that Buddhism has often fallen into in Asia.
So how do you address that? Particularly, I guess I'm interested in how you think about, as a Buddhist, addressing issues like social justice, for example.
Well, there's a couple of ways to go there. I mean, I think part of that problem, say, from the Buddhist tradition, Buddhism, I think, has to change. And part of that is looking back at the way that we have been understanding such things as karma and rebirth. And a number of us are starting to suspect that the way the tradition understands it now is, in fact, a distortion of what the Buddha was really getting at. That what he was really focusing on was motivations, how it is that by changing our motivations, we can change ourselves. I mean, so that he wasn't encouraging the sort of thing we have now where it would just be a matter of accepting your fate, but it's rather the focus is on by changing our motivations that we change our character, and then the way we experience the world will change as well. Now, that's one side of it. The other side is I'm quite fascinated by how it's possible to apply what Buddhism says about the self to issues of the group self or group identity. For example, Buddhism emphasizes, and this is one simple way to understand the Buddhist teachings, that we have to transform our greed, ill will, and delusion into more positive counterparts, greed into generosity, ill will into loving kindness, delusion into wisdom. What's fascinating to consider today is we have new types of collectivities, institutions. Do we have such a thing as institutionalized greed? Well, that, of course, is tying into the market. Mm-hmm. Do we have such a thing as institutionalized ill will? Well, we have militarism. Do we have institutionalized delusion? Well, excuse me for this environment, but you could look at the public media and to a large extent even our educational systems now as encouraging a certain ignorance about what's often going on. So it seems like in that way the Buddhist teachings can be extrapolated to look at social identities, social groups, and they seem to make a lot of sense there as well.
Well, let's talk with someone else. Indiana, next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I've often been surprised, I guess, is the best term for religious groups in particular, though not necessarily, but basically, that when they come upon this feeling, which you call of lack, some philosophers would call it, you know, you're not hooked up with being. You know, I'm thinking about like Heidegger, for example. You're not hooked up with being in a proper way, you know. I guess what I've heard you say, the Buddhists say you just haven't turned internally enough to understand the self. I don't see why you just don't accept it's some biochemical reaction in the body and move on. Thanks a lot.
I guess I have to say I'm not totally clear what the question is, but from a Buddhist standpoint, the kind of transformation that we need, you know, isn't something that could be conditioned into us just, I think, by taking a pill, that it involves a kind of reconstruction or a reformation of the self that has to do with our intentions, with our whole stance, our whole way of approaching the world. And I'm not sure how that could be, you know, simply solved by taking a pill.
All right. Well, let's go to another call. This is Champagne and line 2. Hello.
Yes. I was at your talk last night, and I'm very interested in this notion of the religion and the markets in our particular era. In other words, in particular, I'm wondering whether, and let me sort of make this statement and then ask the question, I'm wondering whether there is, as Americans, that in our particular era, there's a timely aspect to this that, and very specific, historically specific to our era, insofar as we have, of course, on the one hand, certain evangelical, perhaps neoconservative Christians who are promoting a kind of radicalized laissez-faire capitalism approach to the world order, and they of course try to find proof for this in the Bible and so on. Not very successfully, I think, but at any rate, they're promoting this kind of a world order, and of course, along with them, a neoconservative, much larger political wing, which is of course attempting to reorganize the World Bank and attempting to destroy the welfare state. And what I'm wondering is, is it possible that, I know last night you didn't really speak to this to any great degree, but are there forms of capitalism, I mean, in the larger sense of the term, of course, Buddhism speaks to the problem of capitalism and of desire and delusion. But I'm wondering whether there are certain forms of capitalism that are more communal, more satisfying than others, that is, let's say, the welfare state, which, of course, some most countries, except for the United States, have some form of welfare state, and it's only recently, of course, that the United States is generally, increasingly moving toward the destruction of the welfare state as a whole, and of course, the destruction of Social Security. This would happen as well, and all sense of communality, by extension, we might imagine, might fall away. And I can note, for example, that even today, literally in the news, the first library in any community shut down since the 1980s occurred as of today. So the level to which communities are not even funding local communal projects, the schools, the extent to which, of course, on the national level, there's no willingness to support states, and states, of course, are not willing to raise taxes. People are not willing to pay taxes. That this rabid individualism about which you spoke last night is all the more real in our era, and the consumerism is run amok, but that this is very specific to our situation, our historical situation, and I just wanted you to speak to that.
Hmm. Well, I think your question is very important, but as I think you already know, there's no very clear answer within the Buddhist tradition. I mean, the Buddha himself didn't have anything to say about capitalism, corporate or not. But there are, in fact, some indications within what he did say that I think we can apply today. For example, he did make the point in a couple sutras that, governments, rulers do have responsibility for the welfare of their subjects. There's one famous sutra where when people become poor, lose their jobs, and they steal, when the king has them arrested, he doesn't. At first, he sort of gives them something to help them, but later on, he decides, well, this is becoming a bad habit, so he starts chopping off their heads, and treating them very, very seriously, punishing them very badly. But the conclusion of this very interesting talk is that the society falls apart. By treating the subjects harshly, the society collapses, and the point is being made that governments do have a responsibility for the welfare of their peoples. And so I think in some ways we could apply that to what we have come to call the welfare state today. My talk last night, didn't give an answer. I mean, I don't think Buddhism or any other tradition or religion does have a very clear answer about what to do with capitalism, whether that's something to be replaced or whether it's something to be modified. And I'm not enough of an economist to give an answer to that either. I think that's something for us to work out along the lines of these kinds of traditional points.
I definitely think that your talk is extremely timely, though, in this regard, that it makes us to think about the possibilities of alternatives to the kind of rabid consumerism and individualism in our era and on every level of our life and society. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We are a little bit past our midpoint here. And for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, perhaps I should introduce again our guest, and we'll talk with some other people who are listening. David Loy is professor at the Faculty of International Studies at Bunkyo University, which is near Tokyo. Before that, he also taught for a number of years in the philosophy department at the National University of Singapore and is interested in comparative philosophy, that is, comparing philosophy of the East and the West. And particularly, he is interested in bringing Buddhist perspectives to bear on contemporary social issues, things like terrorism and violence and globalization and biotechnology. He's author of a number of books. He also has practiced Zen Buddhism for many years. In 1987, he was recognized as a Zen teacher. He's here visiting the campus. He's the 2005 Marjorie Hall Thulin Visiting Scholar in Religion and Contemporary Culture, and he gave a talk last night dealing with some of these ideas we discussed at the beginning, this whole business of the religion of the market. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something just for a moment I want to ask you about, and we'll get back to people who are listening. One of the things that I think is interesting about Buddhism and is a little bit more true of Buddhism than other religions, although I suppose it has happened in other religions, is the fact that as Buddhism spread out, it starts in India, and then it's carried to various other places around the world, into China, into Japan, into Southeast Asia, and it comes to the Americas, of course. As it moves, different people who come to it already with different sorts of ideas and different traditions have a way of putting their own spin on it, and it takes different forms. And this is something that I've asked, you know, people like you more than once, and I'm not sure I've ever feel like I've gotten a really good answer. But the question is, do you think that there are ways in which American Buddhism is different from Buddhism that you might find any place else, you know, China, Japan, Thailand, Vietnam? And is there something special, do you think, that that American Buddhism brings to the table of Buddhism in a larger sort of sense?
You're exactly right that Buddhism, as one of the three great missionary religions, has spread in a rather unique way. It tends to infiltrate, sort of acting almost as a virus. It's not a very nice analogy, but a virus that mutates to meet the local culture and transforms the local culture. There's a kind of mutual transformation that goes on. So, for example, in China, what we identify as Zen or Chan Buddhism is really a result of such a process like that. It's as much Taoist as it is Buddhist, although most people aren't aware of that. So your question is, what particular forms, what particular mutations are occurring now that Buddhism is entering the West? One of them, well, there has been a very interesting and I think very productive Buddhist-Christian dialogue, but I don't think that's the main form. I think the two main forms that are occurring, first of all, it's psychology. There has been an enormous amount of interest among Western psychologists and psychotherapists in Buddhism, to the point that now we have a number of very experienced, trained psychotherapists who are also long-term Buddhist practitioners, some of them Buddhist teachers. So there's a real cross-fertilization going on between the whole psychological, psychotherapeutic tradition and what Buddhism is having to offer. That's quite striking because when you look at the history of psychology, in the West, it's tended to have a pretty good sense of what's wrong, of how things go wrong with human beings, but it hasn't had such a good account of what psychological health is. And Buddhism, of course, brings in the idea of awakening and what an awakening, what a really awakened, how an awakened individual might be living. So that's one of the very productive forms that I think this is one of the ways that Buddhism is transforming the psychological culture of the U.S. And another one, which I've already hinted at earlier, has to do with socially engaged Buddhism, which some people even think of as a totally new type of Buddhism that, given the liberated, more democratic social structures in the West, which enabled Buddhism to free itself from its, you know, authoritarian control, and given the Western Judeo-Christian Islamic emphasis upon social justice, I think Buddhism is starting to adapt its teachings, as I've also been trying to do, to bring in the social justice implications of what Buddhism has to do. So I think, we already touched on that a little bit, talking about religion of the market and various institutional forms of greed and so forth, that I think this is potentially one of the most fruitful aspects of Buddhism in the West now.
Earlier in the beginning part of the conversation, the first part, we talked about the idea of lack, the term that you like to try to put some kind of a name on that feeling that one has that something's missing. Is that, do you think, the primary thing that somehow that brings psychotherapy and Buddhism together? Because it seems that psychotherapy, that also is a fundamental issue that it tries to address. That is that feeling that one might have that something is sort of vague feeling that something is wrong, something is missing, but I'm not sure what it is exactly or what to do about it.
And the Buddhist understanding of that, I think, is quite radical in psychological terms. It's saying that it's not just a matter of sort of the self, changing itself a little bit, adapting, but that the basic problem is the sense of self, and that in order to really solve the disease, the lack that we have, there has to be a fundamental kind of restructuring of how the self works. And I think that's the way in which Buddhism is really trying to deepen the psychological dialogue.
Well, let's talk with some more people who are listening. Someone in Urbana next, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I'm not sure where to go with what you've said so far, actually. But I did want to make a couple of comments, and then I've got a question. And the first comment, I guess, would be that you should be mentioning that if you're going to talk about the market, you should be talking about Bhutan a little bit or at least I understand that there the prime minister launched a way to measure national progress that is not the gross national product that other countries have, but instead he's initiated something called the gross national happiness. And as I understand it, that's one way that Buddhism is showing itself to, you know, be showing an alternative to our way of the American way of life, so to speak. And another comment is that Nietzsche, I understand, thought that there were preconditions of Buddhism. And I guess I'd want you to comment on this. You were saying that Buddhism kind of adapts, but Nietzsche thought to have Buddhism, you really needed, quote, a very mild climate, very gentle and liberal customs, and no militarism, unquote. And it seems to me a lot of what you've talked about kind of avoids the question, one of the key problems, and that is that where there is militarism, Buddhism doesn't really have a good way to a good answer to it. And then here's the question that I wanted to ask, and that is that I've heard that there is, or I've read that there are like countervailing concepts in Buddhism, the wheel of Dharma and the wheel of Karma. And that's what I was hoping to get a little more explanation of from you.
Okay, well, that's a lot. We only have 15 minutes. Go ahead.
Well, very briefly, I appreciate the reference to Bhutan. You're quite right there. They've recently had a conference where they're trying to find new measures instead of gross national product, which is just a measurement of how much people have spent in total. They're trying to come up with a new index. And I don't know specifically what that's including, except for one thing that really stood out in my mind, the concept of gross national smiles. Can you imagine measuring how many people smile or how much people smile? And of course, that's something to smile and laugh about, but that is an indication of something, isn't it? How much people seem to be happy. Regarding Nietzsche, well, Nietzsche was writing at a time when the understanding of Buddhism wasn't so clear. It tended to be taken in a rather nihilistic way, and he saw it as a religion for an exhausted people. But as far as his criteria are concerned, a mild, it's only suitable for mild people. Well, the immediate counterexample that comes to mind is Tibet. I can't think of a more more hostile, more difficult environment than that high, windswept plateau, and yet Buddhism seemed to thrive there, as it did in Mongolia and a number of other places in northern Asia as well. So to tell the truth, I think Nietzsche, as an understanding of Buddhism, is a little bit dated. We know so much more about the tradition now. As far as your actual question, I confess I'm not actually aware of that distinction, except that it may be saying that, you know, Buddhism isn't just talking about how karma works and how our motivations and intentions recreate the reality that we're in, but it's also saying that ultimately you're trying to step off that track, that enlightenment isn't just a matter of improving your karma, but rather seeing through it and realizing some other dimension to life. And that's very true. It's not just a matter of improving the circumstances of your life, but coming to some kind of special awakening, which will, of course, encourage the same sort of transformation, but it's a deeper understanding of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So Buddhism does make that distinction.
Well, we do have some other callers. I appreciate the comments of the last, and let's go on here to talk with someone here again, here locally in Champaign-Urbana. Line two. Hello.
Hello. Yes, interesting comment, please, on the current Zen, say, in East Asia today. Are there special days of the week where everyone flocks to a temple, or do they just pretty much go only on festivals like B-O-N, Bon? And what about vegans, and what about facing inward or outward in a meditation? Because years ago there was a Western journalist who enjoyed a stay in a monastery in Japan, but basically prevailed on them. He asked for more protein in the diet, and they accommodated him, but otherwise he liked the 3 a.m. rising and cold water showers and getting hit with a stick and so on. Do they still do that?
Yes, they do. If you go to a traditional Zen monastery, that's still what you're going to get. As far as whether you sit facing in or out, that depends. There's two basic types of Zen in Japan, Soto and Rinzai, and the Rinzai people send, you know, they all sit in a circle, but the Rinzai face in and the Soto usually face out toward the walls or the windows. In general, though, although Japan is a Buddhist country, it's quite remarkably different from the type of Buddhism that Shakyamuni Buddha himself taught. He didn't have much to say, if anything, about funerals, and yet that's really what it is in Japan now. Most Japanese don't have anything to do with Buddhism except when, you know, grandfather dies or it's time for memorial service. It's totally associated with death. If you want to get married, you might do that in a Christian chapel because they love the white gowns and so forth. But Buddhism has really been reduced, I think, in the Japanese consciousness for most people as surrounding death and death rituals, unfortunately. Mm. And, of course, there still is Zen tradition that has a much deeper understanding, but it's a very minor part of the Japanese tradition. When I first went to Japan, you know, there's the assumption, you know, all Japanese are Zen Buddhist, and it's just not true. They, many of them know less about Buddhism than many educated Americans.
Very interesting. Let's go to another caller here. This is Loda, line three. Hello.
Yes, hello. So good to hear the Dharma on radio. Thank you. One comment. I think that the previous caller in his comment about Buddhists not fighting or implying that they should not fight in Sri Lanka, I think that having studied Buddhism for a while, I think that the practice of Buddhism doesn't say that we should not fight. If somebody is stepping on our toes, it's totally okay to brush them off as long as one does it compassionately. But one, Buddhism doesn't mean to just roll down and die and not defend our rights. So that's one point. And another point is that Buddhists, I find from my readings, that they seem to be extraordinarily strong in the way that they do resist, for example, the Tibetans, the China invasion. in that it is, again, they fight, but it's a much different type of fight than we see here in the West. And so that's what I want to make the comment. Now the question. Having studied for 2 years here, I have not told my friends that I'm a Buddhist because I fear, in other words, do you think that if here in the West, if Christians really thought that Buddhism was coming, would they burn us at the stake? I mean, if they really thought Buddhism is coming, how have you perceived the, especially in this community in the Midwest, how is Buddhism being thought of? And then my last comment is to tell the Christians, relax. Buddhism is beautiful. It is a practice of the mind. That person that can control the mind is free. Free of suffering, is full of compassion, and it's just lovely, lovely practice. Thank you.
Thank you for your remarks. Well, I appreciate a number of things there. The first is mentioning again the problem of violence and resistance. One thing I forgot to mention with regard to Sri Lanka is that there's some very strong Buddhist influence movements that are working against the violence, in particular the Sarvodaya movement, which has hundreds of villages and many tens of thousands of people involved, not all of them Buddhist, but in principle a kind of Buddhist approach toward nonviolence. And as you realize, I think nonviolence doesn't mean passivity. It doesn't just mean rolling over and accepting what's done to you, but that there's something very active about it. The classic example, of course, would be somebody like Gandhi, who wasn't a Buddhist, although he was influenced by Buddhism, but he was aware of how nonviolence can be taken as a very powerful technique to resist what's being done to one without dualizing. The problem of violence, of course, is that we usually dualize between ourselves and the other person, and we it's important in a nonviolent resistance not to do that, not to demonize the other, but to appreciate their own humanity. And I think one reason Gandhi was so successful is that he never did that to the English. And I think that's an important challenge for us now. You look at the war on terrorism, and I think one of the tragedies of that is the way that each side has been demonizing the other and therefore not really understanding the other. Regarding the reception of Buddhism within the U.S., it's quite striking in a number of ways. One thing I've noticed recently, I came upon a statistic which startled me, that there are perhaps between 4 and 6 million people who consider themselves Buddhists, but moreover, 24, 26 million people who have been influenced by Buddhism, for whom that has somehow changed their world, which is quite striking. It suggests that Buddhism is having a significant impact. I've been very involved at different times with Buddhist-Christian dialogue, which has been very active, and at that level, there's no problem of Christians and Buddhists talking to each other. It seems to me often it's not between religions, but often within religions, that it's the more progressive liberal Christians have a much harder time dealing with their own very fundamentalist wings than they do dealing with other Buddhists. And somehow that's the real challenge at this point, not just dialoguing with other religions, but religions dialoguing with themselves, that if we're going to address the kind of social issues that are facing us today, religions are going to have to start doing that more successfully than they have been doing. Just internal dialogue.
Hmm. Well, again, I thank the caller. We had somebody else, but I guess they changed their mind. You know something, we don't really have a lot of time here, but something that I'm really very interested in that you have written about, I'd like to have you talk at least a couple of minutes about, is some of the things you deal with in the book, looking at myth and Buddhism. And the point has been made, certainly, that myth and popular stories, things like The Lord of the Rings, for example, people have looked at them and done a kind of a done an analysis of them for Christian themes. Mm-hmm. You've written a book which you do the same sort of do the same kind of exercise and look at popular myth like that in popular literature and look for Buddhist themes that I think is really a fascinating idea. Maybe you could talk about that for a minute or two.
Sure. I suppose I should add, to be fair to the co-author, my wife Linda Goodhue.
Yes, indeed. I should not cut her out of the project here.
Well,
absolutely.
She was very much a part of it because she's the literary side of it, and we're both fascinated by one of her specialties is children's literature and fantasy. And so we realized as we read and enjoyed these things together that what we thought were Buddhist themes kept popping up again and again. Watching the films Lord of the Rings, we realized that there's a certain almost Buddhist attitude toward karma that's going on there, how it is the world depicted in Lord of the Rings is a karmic world where good intentions lead to good results and bad intentions are self-defeating. So we explored that and how, and if you look also, say, at Frodo's whole attitude, he was going on this quest not to gain something, but to give something up, to let go of something. Well, what's more Buddhist than that when the whole point of the path is to let go of yourself? But not only Lord of the Rings, we also talk about a wonderful book by the German writer Michael Ende called Momo. He's better known for The Neverending Story, which was made into some films. Mm-hmm. But Momo is a wonderful fantasy about time. There's also the Japanese anime director Miyazaki and the wonderful American science fiction and fantasy writer Ursula Le Guin. And in all of these works, we find very fascinating Buddhist themes, not using the word Buddhism, the point being that there's a basic understanding of the world that is sometimes expressed in Buddhist terms, but it's much broader than that. You could call it the Dharma if you want. Hmm. The Buddha himself never taught Buddhism. He taught Dharma, which is much larger, and I think we find that expressed in some of these fantasies.
Well, we're going to have to stop. By the way, if you're interested in reading on this subject, you can look for the book that David Loy and Linda Goodhue have written. It's titled The Dharma of Dragons and Demons. I know it is now available in a paperback, so you can look for it. Our guest, David Loy, he's professor in the Faculty of International Studies, Bunkyo University near Tokyo in Japan. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Our show's made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square. Our show's made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from REMAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. REMAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. The show also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. They've been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, and the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine in Urbana, carrying a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer.